Spacers from Austin, Texas. I'm Christopher Schmidt, and on today's show, I'm talking with Bryn Lanier. She is a UX product designer, speaker, and writer based out of Durham, North Carolina. So notes where you can see me, I'll be hosting the Access U Summit. It's a one-day, one-track virtual conference event about advanced web and mobile accessibility. Learn new accessibility knowledge without leaving the office. Individual and meeting room tickets are available right now at accessusummit.com. Again, that's one word, accessusummit.com. Also, I'll be hosting the CSS DevConf. It's a two-day conference taking place in October 17th through the 18th in San Antonio, Texas. We tackle everything from CSS to JavaScript to everything in between. We have some great speakers lined up from Chris Coyer, Jonathan Snook, Rachel Neighbors, Wes Boss, just Estelle Weil, just a whole great lineup. Check for early bird tickets now at cssdevconf.com, at cssdevconf.com. As for non-breaking space, you can set it to forget it with our show newsletter. It'll arrive in your email box around Wednesdays when the show is ready and we have a hot, fresh show for you. Just sign up at newsletter.nonbreakingspace.tv. You can also see all the show notes and links mentioned at nonbreakingspace.tv for this episode. And if you would, you can follow me on Twitters at Telejet. Again, it's T-E-L-E-J-E-C-T. And as always, thank you for subscribing, liking, and telling others about Nonbreaking Space Show on iTunes. Now, on with the show. Say thanks for taking the time to be here on the show.
It's exciting.
Cool. So one of the things we always ask right away is, how did you first encounter the web, or what was your first reaction to the web?
You know, I think I first encountered the web as a high school student. Mm-hmm. And I remember I used to go to Yahoo, the directory of the internet, mm-hmm. and drill down from category to category in the basement of the library at the university where my father taught, because that was the only place I could access the internet from. I loved it. Every weekend I wanted to go over there and be able to explore the web. I think I used Mosaic a lot. I started building for the web in college. I got a terrible case of poison ivy, and my boyfriend at the time, I think I was driving him nuts, whining about the itching and how miserable I was. I was in this apartment with no air conditioning and just hot and itchy. And he said, "You need a hobby." And I went to geocities.com and started a web page.
Did you build a website about poison ivy, or?
I did not. I think I built one of those early sort of personal websites. Yeah. I forget which town in GeoCities I was in. Oh, okay. It was something horrible and had like blinky GIF backgrounds and things. Oh,
nice. Yeah, I love Yahoo's random site button. It was a really interesting looking button. It was like, they had like little buttons for like, you know, go to a URL or like add a URL or whatever. But they had this like really nice Yahoo button, mm-hmm. kind of staticky thing, whatever. No, it was pretty nice for its time. And I would always click it because I was like, thought, oh yes, random. Take me since do some random space I've never been to before. I love it. But yeah, I remember the old Yahoo directory. And so, yeah, we used to be able to catalog the web in their directory.
I kind of miss that web sometimes, you know? I do.
Yeah, it was finite.
Yes.
So, one of the things I want to talk to you today is just, you know, just see what you're working on, what your thoughts are these days. And so one of the things that you've been thinking about is the importance of process. And so this is something that comes up at Advice for Humans, especially when you do the Responsive Web Design Summit. You know, we talked about process, you know, in the early days of this, Responsive Web Design, it was always about like, hey, this whole like design in Photoshop and throw it over the ledge to the coders to code it up is not working out, because, you know, they'll design it for a fixed width and then we have to come back and it's just taking too much. And then we have to get the clients involved involved in it and actually like show them what's going on. And it's just, you know, it's a totally different way of a process. So what is your thinking?
You know, I have this crazy love-hate relationship with process, because I've been on a lot of teams and I've worked with a lot of teams that sort of see process as this silver bullet to all of their problems. And they're like, man, if we could just fix our process. And you go in there and you realize that there's like a lack of clear leadership, or there's an unwillingness to make hard decisions, that there are personality conflicts, that there's a lack of alignment in priorities. You see all of these other problems and you think, man, like process isn't going to fix this, you know? And so I do think that for a lot of teams, it's easier to blame their process as the root of their dysfunction, as opposed to sort of looking at their culture, looking at, maybe various negative behaviors that are having a negative effect on the team and the work. They're like, oh man, if we just get a new process in here, everything will be great. But, right. You know, at the same time, especially when I work with designers who are newer to product design or newer to app design, you know, their questions aren't really about UI. Like their questions aren't really about, how do I handle some kind of navigation challenge? Their questions are, how do I work with these clients? How do I show them this thing? It's about managing stakeholders, managing expectations, figuring out when to show deliverables, like when is it too soon? When is it too late? So many process questions. So yeah, it's like understanding the limitations of process, but also being willing to constantly challenge yourself to improve your process, to look for gaps, but not getting kind of tunnel vision on your process, to also look at your team culture and look at everything that's going on around process as well.
Yeah, it seems like processes can be very seductive in a way, because I remember working on a process when I worked for an agency, and it was just like, yeah, we'll just work on the process and try to. And we had this massive document, which I think we, as soon as it was finished done, no one cared about it. So it's so I think it's also maybe it's a way of saying, it's the process's fault when it's actually like, Bob in engineering is just really just not helping out. Right. So,
yeah, it's absolutely. And especially leadership, because sometimes the problem is at the top, and, with like the owner or the CEO or the, the product owner or whomever, and, they don't want to look at themselves as the problem, so they want to blame process. It's always easier to blame, that fifth team member named process than somebody who you work with every day.
So if there's a problem with the culture, like how would you go about or suggesting people tackle that, especially if they're someone who isn't at the top? It's really hard to I would imagine it'd be somewhat difficult and frustrating to say just to hear like, oh, we have to fix culture. Like, what does that entail? Or is there something else they should be doing?
Yeah. That is where I am not an expert on, culture fixes. Because, it's, what is that Tolstoy line? Like every happy family is the same and every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. I think every dysfunctional team is dysfunctional in its own way. I do think it's important just to recognize the limitations of what process change can bring. Mm-hmm. And that if you're trying to fix your team or fix your company with a process change and that's not working and not getting you the results that you want, then maybe you need to sort of take a harder look, and maybe it's not process's fault after all.
Right. And then is there a difference between because you have culture in terms of building a product and that's internal, and then you have to deal with clients. And so, and that's and stakeholders, are kind of maybe different than the clients, right? So is there, you know, is there anything that you can suss out in terms of like how someone could help deal with that at all? Or
yeah, I mean, that's a challenging thing, is at least, you know, in agency work, you know, you typically have, you know, the team that's doing the work and the client. And sometimes you need to suss out like their ghost stakeholders, you know, VPs who aren't coming to meetings, but who actually have approval over the process. You know, it can be the same way in-house, you know, with depending on how large the organization is that you're working in. And yeah, and I think that sometimes on either side, you know, you, the person doing the work, are often the low person on the totem pole, and you just kind of have to work within whatever culture your clients or stakeholders may have. And I've known teams that got very unhappy because of the negative culture of their clients. I think we've all had clients like that, that we didn't like the way clients treated us as the agency. We didn't like the way they treated their internal team members. And it's, you know, process can't fix that.
Yeah, it's, you know, that's for sure. I think the main thing I've seen and we have people talk about process and stakeholders is just to get clients on board, mm-hmm. and stakeholders on fast enough in terms of showing what you're doing and how you're building. And a lot of that has to do with like building within the browser, showing people what it means as you build in the browser. Also, you know, especially you see this in a lot of the UX talks, is that you could do a whole bunch of UX testing and, you know, doing lab analysis and case study, people come in and do stuff, but no one's going to read the reports or believe the reports unless they actually come in and actually see you. See people, potential customers, interacting with the product, mm-hmm. and doing that, because otherwise it's just, you know, words on a page that they can easily ignore. So
yeah,
I think that can dive into culture, where, you know, it's kind of like show your work type of atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, you do the case studies, but you have to bring people in and, mm-hmm.
and show. And yeah, and that sort of getting hands on and getting involved is also part of culture. You know, if you're working in a place where teams are very siloed, or if you're working in a place where you're working with one team, but they're trying to box this other team out, you know, and like there's kind of friction there, then they're not going to want that other team like included in the testing or brought in early. They're fighting turf wars, and, you know, your process can't necessarily overcome their turf wars. You can try. But you can say over and over again, oh no, we need everybody to be there for user testing, but sometimes it'll work, sometimes it won't.
Right. So you also have thoughts on, what is it? I noticed you mentioned a UI design versus product design.
Yeah. You know, I think when I talk to people about being a product designer, I think there's a perception that most of what we do is just design product interfaces. And I know that is a large chunk of my work. I think it's a large chunk for a lot of product designers. At the same time, you know, I think there's this shifting definition of product designer. And you know, we talk sometimes about startup founders as product designers, even though they might not be the person actually executing the UI designs. So yeah, I think it's important to think about product design as something that spans, you know, the whole breadth of the product, including the business needs and, you know, working with the development team on execution, understanding technical limitations, overcoming the UX challenges. It's much bigger than just like the toggles on the UI.
Yeah, I'm personally having trouble just coming to, like, I don't know, trouble per se, but just the whole term of product design and product. Like, I'm a project manager, and I was like, really, you make widgets? Like, I don't like what you make. What do you make? And I was like, no, it's a website product. I'm like, oh, well you. I mean, apparently, while I was sleeping on the job, apparently it became, people just stopped wanting to be called web designers and web app makers. And it's like, I make a product. I'm like, that's great. why is there a website here?
You know, I think I was drawn to it. I hit a point I guess it's been about 3 years ago now. I hit a point where I started to get bored with designing quote unquote websites. I started to get bored with designing what we might think of as like the typical marketing brochure website, because I'd been designing that for at least 5 years. And I had designed many versions of it for many different clients. And so people would come to me and they would say, oh, I have this website. You're like, Ren, you're a web designer. I have this website I need you to design. And I needed a polite way to sort of explain to them that I don't want to design those websites anymore. that I only want to work on apps, at least at this moment. And so I think product designer for me becomes a way to distinguish between those two kinds of work.
Right. Yeah. Well, to me, a product designer just seems has a more physical connotation.
Yeah.
And so I feel like that's a little, maybe it's borrowing too much from, I don't know, other media or other processes. I don't know. Maybe.
I get that. I totally get that.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, it just feels a little uncomfortable to me. So, it takes time. I get used to it. I don't know. I could definitely see where people can get tired of doing just simple websites. And so, well, let's go back. Like, I want to go back to that. You poison ivy hobby making websites. So how did you get from poison ivy websites as a hobby learning to your first full job as a web designer?
You know, I came out of college with an English degree.
And nice.
Yeah, super employable. But again,
what was your focus of study? Sorry.
I would say probably American modern literature.
Nice.
So lots of Hemingway, Fitzgerald.
Okay.
Yes, Eliot.
Nice.
So yeah, I came out super employable, only due to the fact that I had this case of poison ivy. So while, you know, in addition to moving through my senior year of college, I had also continued to learn HTML, and it started, you know, that was like the early, early days of CSS. Really teaching myself how to build websites, and fell into a marketing job after I graduated that gave me an opportunity to really practice and learn how to be a designer. I don't have formal design education. So, you know, I had a chance to design brochures, to design emails, to design booklets, to design sales sheets, just, you know, all of that very businessy, boring kind of stuff. I probably spent the first 7 years of my career working in marketing. And then in 2008, lost my last marketing job in the Great Recession when the markets collapsed. I was actually sort of working in investor relations, kind of tangential to finance. So when the markets collapsed, we all lost our jobs. It's amazing how much, especially working on products, I often work on products, things like CRM or you know, I'm working on e-commerce retention and analytics now. The products I work on are often similar to products that I would have used in that earlier life of mine in marketing. Yeah. And I can often apply, you know, that's where I really learned about the importance of the call to action, the importance of calculating ROI, like all of these fundamental business concepts that I then take and apply to the business products that I'm developing.
And so how long have you been in the position that you're in now? Like, what is your day job right now?
What is my day job?
What does it look like?
I am a senior product designer at a startup here in Durham called Windsor Circle.
See, I just insulted you earlier by like product designer. Like, I don't understand you, whippersnapper. great. By the way, Chris, I'm a product designer, a senior.
Sorry about that. So I work on a product team. You know, so the company itself is about 80 people. My product team is about 5 people, which I always think is fascinating in that everyone else at this company is selling or supporting or developing the product. and there are like 5 of us kind of conceiving and designing it. So I've only been here a couple of months, but it's exciting. I enjoy I enjoy working in the startup environment. It's also nice to work in a sort of larger startup of, you know, 80 people as opposed to just like six of us sitting around a table. Yeah. But like all startups, there was a point at which this company was also six people sitting around a table. So,
right. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Like everyone just does everything when you're six people.
Yes.
And then when it's eight people, it's people get used to, I mean, not used to, but they know what they're doing day in, day out usually. So
yes.
Cool. Awesome. Do you build native apps where you are, or is it just a web product?
We are a web product. Okay. I worked on a native iOS app in my last position at HiRise. Oh, yeah. But we have not gotten into any native apps right now. And again, that is purely based on who our users are in the context of their use, which is marketers sitting at their desks in a web browser day after day. But I'm sure that's something that's going to increase in importance in the coming months. I think that, you know, supporting tablet users in particular becomes more and more critical every day. I have friends who enthusiastically call themselves glass tappers and do their work, their real serious work, all day long using nothing but an iPad on iOS.
That's like cool and scary at the same time.
Yeah. and I get to sort of eavesdrop on their complaints, like in a Slack channel, and hear them complain about, you know, iOS and saving PDFs and workflow issues between apps. And it's this whole different way of thinking about working and workflows that's different than like our typical multi-app desktop experience that most of us use every day. But I think supporting those folks is going to become very necessary soon.
Yeah. I mean, it's I think a minor example would be the, photography apps, right? So it's it took me a while to realize that you know, I would see all these amazing photos in like Instagram and whatnot, and it took me a while to realize that people were just taking photos, taking it to one photo app, exporting it, and then running it through another photo app, and so it was just like this crazy workflow that they were doing in terms of trying to get that picture that they just took with their camera without having to, like, you know, go back or open up a laptop or whatever, you know, Photoshop. And it was, at one hand, it was really cool. On the other hand, it was like, wow, this is really sluggish. You know, this is kind of,
yeah.
And then at the other hand, it's like, well, if they kind of fix this problem, if you will, they're going to be putting a desktop on a tablet, which is, you know, it doesn't have the resources just yet for it. But I feel like, I was like, man, I hope we don't reinvent the desktop. I hope we solve the desktop problem. Because, like, I love working on the laptop. Yeah, he said. But he said, like, oh, I love working on I'd rather be in the movies. I'm working. I'm in good, cool locations. But no, laptops are cool, Chris. Okay. But you get a lot more done and more. I guess it fits my ADD mentality better. I can just have so many windows open.
Yeah. And you know, my friends who are really into iOS, you know, they often use it as a way to counteract their ADD. Like, it forces them into monotasking.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, eliminates all of these distractions. You know, they call it, it's like working on that thin layer, you know, between them and, you know, all of their data in the cloud somewhere. So it's almost like their personal life hack or whatever. But, you know, to me, I need all of the apps all of the time, all of the browser windows.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's pretty cool. I mean, that's pretty cool. I wish I think there's a good book involved in that in terms of workflow.
Yeah.
There isn't already. So, but yeah, I just don't see that happening. I mean, I would love to, I love for it to work, but I just, you know. It's like we're Advanced Humans, we're a small company, so I just, you know, I don't know when I'll need Photoshop at any point in time and be able to do that. So, but hopefully with CSS filters, we won't need that for too much longer. So,
I use Sketch full time now. I haven't used Photoshop on the reg in several years now.
I use Photoshop forever. So yeah, Sketch is amazing. Like Sketch reminds me of a little bit of Slack in terms of how well it's taken off and being sustained. So what do you use Sketch for?
You know, interface design, wireframing. You know, I will even get to a point if I need to do almost like a personal sticky note process, I'll just start making little colored squares in Sketch sometimes just to mind map for myself. Yeah.
So instead of like just doing like AI, like in the, was it Graphel?
Yeah.
So you just jury rig Sketch for that. Oh, how cool.
Yeah.
So what is the workflow for a Sketch app for teams?
You know, these days it seems like most teams are doing a Sketch to Envision sort of workflow. There are tons and tons of, Sketch is doing these amazing add-ons. What is it? It's called like Craft with the data add-on to Sketch. So they've got plugins, including plugins that really allow you to like to prototype inside Sketch. But it feels like most product teams are getting kind of 85% of the way there, 90% of the way there with Sketch and Envision. And then it's like that last 10%, everybody is going to maybe some other tool for animation. So maybe they're going to Framer.js. Maybe they're going directly into CSS JavaScript. Maybe they're using a proto.io. Like there are tons and tons of more advanced prototyping tools. And that's when everything sort of, segments and breaks. But when I talk to new designers joining the field, I'm like, learn Sketch, get Envision. There's not even that much learning to do with Envision. It's so easy. Yeah. That seems to be the workflow that most teams have coalesced around right now.
Yeah. It floors me how many people have started using Sketch, which is, it's great, but it just like, it really takes a lot for software to just, I think, pierce through, and just make an impact. Like Slack is one of those, or just came out of nowhere and it stuck around and it's been everywhere. So,
and Sketch is so powerful, and it costs like $79. And I think that, not only do they have a really great tool set, but it's at a really amazing price. And they came to market right as Adobe switched everything over to subscriptions,
right?
And to me, I can't even imagine that it's worth paying $50 a month for me to have a subscription to this whole Adobe suite when all I would ever really use was Photoshop and maybe Illustrator.
I don't know. There's like, sometimes you just have like, all of a sudden you just want to break down and just break open and like, I don't know, audio audition. I don't know.
Yeah.
It seems like I was very frustrated. It's really frustrating how software companies are just going to subscription service, and it's just I don't get it. I get it, but then at the same time, I just like I can't bemoan them for changing it, but I just feel like when you have like a text expander, I don't want to throw text. I guess I'll throw a text expander as an example. Just subscription model, and I was just like, well, they're totally in the right to do that, but. But I've been with Text Expander since at least, I think, before 2011, if not earlier. And now it's like, when it comes time to renew, I'm not even going to bother, just because I don't need to be paying for, I've already invested my time and money into it. I just, what more do you want from me?
I know.
any projects you're working on like any books or anything else, like ideas, concepts?
I am 32 weeks pregnant.
Well, yeah, you're working on a project right here.
So that is my current project. Trying to get back to writing, but have mostly been really busy with my team. Between my team and this other product that I'm going to ship in about 8 weeks.
Oh, nice.
Has been taking up most of my attention, but it's interesting how, I think it's good to go through periods of like working really hard and learning and observing, yeah. and then sort of like writing and speaking and putting things out there. So I've sort of had a quiet period where I've been absorbing a lot. Now I need to put some stuff back out there.
Okay. Cool. Awesome. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Knock on wood, and hopefully, hoping for a healthy, happy, bouncy yes. baby. Awesome. Or is it babies?
It was only one.
Only one. Okay. Only one. I think we're some news here, guys. No.
Only one.
Cool. So how can people find you on the internet and follow up if they have any questions or?
Yeah, you know, find me on Twitter, I think is probably the easiest way to find me. And, you know, that's another thing that I think I need to re-engage with more. I think Twitter as a platform has been something that I've probably struggled with over the last year or so of, you know, like, what is this? What is the conversation I'm having? I probably don't post as much about product design and UX design as I should. But at the same time, it feels like there's so many newsletters now. Like there's so many, like I feel like one hits my inbox like every day.
Yeah.
It seems less important to like retweet the latest Medium article about some UX-y thing.
Yeah. It's pretty interesting how like everyone just email is dead, but we get newsletters for everything underneath the sun. So.
Yeah. But, the thing I really want email to die for is honestly, so this is again, like me as the product designer, I hate email as notification. You know, it's like, oh, you just got another message or another, and you get an email and, and it's just like constant, like stuff from apps, like emails from apps. From Facebook, oh, somebody liked your post, somebody reshared your post, and it's like an email into my inbox. And, you know, like thinking about that flow, nobody likes that flow. Like, nobody likes those emails.
Oh, yeah. So I have to like figure out, I have to like spend some time, which is not like the worst thing in the world, but like go through all my Twitter accounts and turn off the email.
Oh, yeah.
Automatically, you know, like, by the way, some celebrity. You should be following right now. It's like,
right?
Like, and that happens every day, right? So I was just like who, why are you spending this much money, which is like, you know, half a fraction of a cent? I'm like, but still, like, you know, just it adds up to just a lot of annoyance, really, just to read all those emails. But I feel like there's plenty of times before this email system happened, though, like I would download an app, set it up, and then I would just totally forget it, right? And then if it wasn't for this app saying, you know, click this link and then you'll be able to re-engage with our app on your phone. You know, maybe I wouldn't, you know, I've totally forgotten, but I think that would happen for a couple of apps that I found.
And some apps do it. So for instance, I always love Slack's magic login email.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'm one of those people who belongs to too many Slack rooms. And, you know, if I change my phone or something or need to add a new Slack room on my phone and just like never remembering my password. The fact that Slack will send me this email with this button and I just, you know, tap it on my phone and boom, I'm into my Slack room. Like that's awesome. Like that is an awesome use of email. But it's more email as notification for activity in the app, you know, like that, because once that means like the more I use your app, the more emails are going to like flood my inbox.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I remember Snowden, he like signed up for Twitter.
Yeah.
But he forgot to turn off notifications. And so he came back to his phone and he had like millions of people had to follow.
Yeah.
That followed him. So I was just like, but yeah. So it's just, there's, you know, there's a business as email as notifications as, you know, these transactions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of annoying, but but I find that as a process, though, that'd be as a workflow for product design. I said the word product design, and
see, I'm getting in your head.
Anything else you think about or
That I'm working on, not off the top of my head. Yeah, well,
enough working on it. Yeah, enough going on.
You know, a lot of what I love to do is you know, I love when I have the time to do various sorts of mentoring to people, you know, new to UX, new to design, maybe not new to the technology field in general. Maybe they're kind of switching in from project management or, you know, from front end development or whatever. But I love working with those folks, kind of getting their perspective on what it's like to be new to this industry in 2016, what their challenges are, you know, always trying to understand and trying to help them develop, because, you know, those folks can't take the same path I took, you know, I can't just be like, oh, just go to GeoCities and whatever, you know, so really, really trying to help them and trying to help understand how do you build a UX career if you're starting today. So I enjoy having those conversations, and just really learning about, you know, kind of what it's like out there, especially in different cities. I've mentored several designers in New York, several very talented, very talented sort of visual designers, UI designers in particular. And I've often talked to them. I was like, you know, you're in New York, like there's so many opportunities there. You're going to find somebody to hire you. Everybody needs a designer. I had at least one of my students tell me, she says, you know, I don't want to work for one of those Uber for something startups. she's like, I know all these VCs. She's like, yeah, there are a lot of startups here, but they're all Uber for something. Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting to hear about, you know, almost like ethical problems like that, you know, I'm just like, oh, I have to go. I mean, I've worked on Uber for something projects myself, but to see that as such a huge trend, you know, it's like, oh, if I want to get a job today, that's the kind of company I'm going to have to work for.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's kind of like, what's the shape of your mentorship? Is it like how do you, for someone to, who would want to get a mentorship, what advice do you give them, or like, what does it look like?
That is a good question. You know, I do mentor through one of the online schools called Design Lab. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I'm signed up to take any more students anytime soon because, again, launching my own little project, but wanting to be mindful of my time and limitations, trying not to take on too much. But you know, I've definitely considered maybe doing some open office hours as well. I think that's a great way to give back to the community. And that's something I may consider very seriously here soon. Mm-hmm. A lot of times it's informal, just through my own personal network, not just going to conferences, but going to a lot of local meetups. Mm-hmm. I just get an email in my inbox from a designer I know who says, hey, do you have a few minutes to chat? and I hear the same things kind of over and over again. But I think I think it's important for all of us to sort of try and keep in touch with people who are new to our industry, right, and not just get into our little cocoon of seniority.
Right. Right. So right away, like your mentorship problem, I mean, advice is like, go build this layout in eight tables, all using HTML tables.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
And then come back to me and tell me your problem.
Okay. Yeah. You know, and for some of these folks, especially if they're in more traditional design programs or come through traditional design school, mm-hmm, you know, where like they're taking classes with these 45-year-old art directors.
Oh, right.
You know, and so every now and again, I'll get a chance to sort of guest lecture for a class. I've got friends who teach, you know, college classes in media and things. And I come in with the most, like, I look at these kids and I'm like, you need to learn HTML. Like, right, these are a bunch of copywriters. And I'm like, you need to learn HTML. Yeah. And then the next thing I tell them is, you're all going to get fired one day. like welcome to the advertising industry. You're going to get fired. It's going to be okay. And I see the looks on their faces. But you know, their professors aren't necessarily preparing them for the difficult world that is out there and the difficult path that's ahead of them.
Yeah, that's like two barrel shots right there. It's like you need to learn code and you're gonna get fired.
it's nothing but tough love right here. Nothing but tough love.
And then you just drop the mic and walk out the door.
Yeah, basically.
Any questions? Right. but it's gonna be okay. I like that too.
You're gonna be okay.
Yeah. See the rule about HTML.
Right. Cool. If you know HTML, you'll be fine.
Right. Cool. Awesome. Well, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. Cool. And I hope to talk to you soon afterwards.
No, I appreciate it. This has been a lot of fun.